is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
Ukraine. I welcome Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Since last we talked, there have been important and surprising developments in Ukraine crisis. I begin with the most recent headline from London. Anatole, a very good day to you. The London Telegraph, the Daily Telegraph associated with the ruling party, the Conservatives, the Tory Telegraph, features a headline with a photograph. Russia and Belarus hold major war games in, quote, violent gesture to Europe. At the same time, we're told NATO is holding exercises on the other side of the battle line. And we know that Ukraine continues to be part of the conversation in all the European capitals. I note in particular Paris, Emmanuel Macron's trip to Moscow to sit at a 20-foot long table with Vladimir Putin, and then his trip to Kiev to sit at a human-sized round table with President Zelensky. At the same time, Chancellor Olaf Scholz making his maiden voyage as the leader of all Germans to America, a joint press conference with the President of the United States. The topic was the same in every capital and every conversation, Ukraine. So a summary of how you've observed these last days since last we talked in Ukraine crisis. Diplomacy seems now to be the card. Is it a winning card in your measure? Good day to you, Anatole.
Hello, John. I think diplomacy could still be a winning card. I mean, there are two hopeful paths. One was raised by the United States in its response to Russia's demands, where the US statement talked about new arms control agreements in Europe, limitation of missiles in particular, and also talked about the need to restart the START nuclear limitation process. It didn't talk about the stationing of conventional armed forces, but at least, this suggests that there is a possibility, for example, of a mutual deal whereby the US withdraws some of the troops it's stationed near Russia's borders, of course, in return for Russia withdrawing the troops that it has deployed close to Ukraine. So I think that's one positive way forward. The other is the one raised by French President Emmanuel Macron, which is to restart the Normandy process aimed at a peace settlement in eastern Ukraine in the Donbass. That has basically been frozen for the past 6 years, but it remains official US policy as well as European policy. The question is whether the West will be prepared to bring pressure to bear on Ukraine to implement this. But clearly, Russia is interested, for the moment at least, in going and talking. Russia continues to make threatening gestures like this, military exercises in Belarus. But I think it's clear that Russia has, and is what US intelligence says as well, has not yet decided on war. So yes, I think there is still a diplomatic way out of this.
You wrote an essay some days past that we discussed about the Minsk II process. I think it's important for us to unpack it these many years later, because the principles are still available in their offices, not the same people. And yet the world has changed considerably since 2015 because of the pandemic, because of the rearrangement of alliances. I'm thinking of Russia and China. So the Minsk II process was at the end of major conflict, war, deaths in Ukraine. And it brought together in the capital of Belarus, to my memory, Vladimir Putin, François Hollande representing France, Angela Merkel representing Germany, and President Poroshenko representing Kyiv. There have been significant changes in that four, in that the only person still available, the memory of the events, is Vladimir Putin, and of course the host, Lukashenko of Minsk. Do you measure that there is promise in reawakening this? I understand there have been talks in Paris because of the, what you'd have to say, sharp differences between the personalities of Zelensky and Poroshenko, between Hollande and Macron, and especially Angela Merkel, now with Olaf Scholz, a man who practiced Ostpolitik when he was younger. So does this look like a more promising quartet than 2015 that could not resolve the conflict?
Well, I don't know whether the quartet is more promising. Obviously, the threat of large-scale war is even greater than in 2015. But I think the most important thing is that the basic element of the Minsk II agreement, which is internationally guaranteed autonomy for the Donbass under Ukrainian sovereignty, is the only way, I mean, the only way that this conflict can be resolved. Because Russia is not going to simply give the Donbass back to a unitary Ukraine. And the Ukrainians cannot enforce that without victory over Russia in war. And to be honest, I mean, a Ukrainian attack on the Donbass is exactly what hardliners in Russia are praying for, because that would give the excuse for a full-scale invasion of Ukraine. So frankly, I mean, if there is to be any peace process there, and if that is to play a part in negotiations with Russia, then it has to be based on some version of Minsk. There just is no other way.
And that would look like, my quick reading of Minsk from 2015, there are a lot of things that have changed. That would look like autonomy for Luhansk and Donetsk republics, autonomy, perhaps for more territory than that. And what we're told in the record, the Rada, the parliament in Kiev, refused to even engage in that conversation, refused to acknowledge Russia's authority to grab a piece of Ukraine. They didn't even discuss Crimea. Russia was presuming, or the Russian representatives were presuming, that was not up to debate. It had already been annexed. Do you measure that the parliament, the Rada of today, would be more disposed to granting that autonomy?
No, I mean, in themselves, they wouldn't, but it would have to be, frankly, an agreement enforced by the West. The West would have to tell the Ukrainians that this was a condition of further Western support. There's no other way. But without such an agreement, of course, the conflict will simmer on and can always, of course, then explode into full-scale war. So if we are to, eliminate the threat of war in Ukraine, this conflict has to be solved.
The news from Moscow, it can change day to day, is that the Belarus exercise that I've flagged in my opening remarks on the front page of the Telegraph, with a wonderful picture taken by a drone, I'm going to presume, of Russian armor moving down a dusty country road. My goodness, that's flat tank country, isn't it, Anatole? My goodness. In Belarus, that's the highway to Kiev, I see them pointing out. Okay. The measure here is that there is another agenda for Vladimir Putin and the Kremlin, and the agenda is NATO. That has nothing to do with Minsk II whatsoever. Minsk II is an easy thing to solve in comparison to the demand, the expectation of Moscow that NATO roll its military infrastructure back to 1997, long understood as an unacceptable term, but Moscow clearly has NATO in mind. What will Moscow accept? What can we measure as Moscow's ambition now about NATO, given that demand is unacceptable?
Well, I suppose there are two possibilities. One is mutual arms limitation. In other words, NATO pulls out some of its forces in return for the Russian demobilization of forces aimed at Ukraine, and perhaps certain reductions in the Russian forces stationed in Kaliningrad. That is, the obvious quid pro quo there, which gives, Russia the appearance of success, but without Western surrender. Because clearly, I mean, any agreements have to involve an element of mutuality. Russia has to give up something as well, naturally. The other possibility is that somehow we find a diplomatic formula to recognize reality, which is that even if the West cannot give up the principle of the possibility of Ukrainian membership of NATO, there is actually no practical possibility of Ukraine joining NATO in the foreseeable future. Because, of course, it has these open conflicts with Russia, And it would require NATO to send huge Western forces, Cold War-style forces, to defend Ukraine. Nobody is planning to do that. So if we could find a formula whereby the West says we stick to the principle that NATO membership is open, however, you know, we acknowledge that for a certain period, NATO membership for Ukraine is not in fact going to happen. I suspect that that would give. I mean, it would also allow the Russians to, you know, to interpret it more strongly. I think that would give enough of a success to Putin to call off the threat of war, because of course the dangers for Russia in an invasion of Ukraine would be huge, and not just, you know, in terms of what would happen on the ground, not just in terms of Western sanctions, but also because, especially if this involved heavy casualties on both sides, you know, there is a great deal of unhappiness in Russia itself about the prospect of war.
One detail, in recent conversation, you flagged the fact that Russia has core national security concerns, core concerns. And you made the excellent debating point that these are not dissimilar to core U.S. national security concerns. Are those being met now? Are the core concerns of Russia feeling threatened by NATO's apparent encroachment on its borderline? Is that being mentioned or addressed by the capitals of Washington, Paris, and Berlin?
To some degree and to varying degrees, yes. I mean, the United States response talked about the indivisibility of security, which is a Russian phrase, you know, which implies Russian security must also be respected. Although the US message also said that, you know, our understanding and Russian understandings are very different. But still, you know, that lays the basis for possible agreement. And France, President Macron has gone much further in talking about how, you know, Russia is a European country and cannot be excluded from European security considerations and structures. So, yes, I think there is. And of course, I think, you know, something else that can be pointed out, certainly it should be pointed out to the Russians, is that, you know, even if the Russians assert their own version of the Monroe Doctrine, it is, in fact, a great many years, I mean, not since the Bay of Pigs, has America actually tried to invade one of its southern neighbors. And even the Bay of Pigs, of course, was, you know, through proxies, not unlike, you know, Russia's proxies in the Donbass. So, you know, the Russians need to have some of their interests accommodated while being, you know, firmly deterred from actually going to war.
I'm speaking with Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He's in Europe. He's in Britain, looking at the crisis in Ukraine. But there is another factor introduced into this conversation in 2022 that did not come up in 2015. China, when we come back. I'm John Batchelor.